On today's episode, we interviewed Josh Anhalt, and man, was this interesting. We talked about what it looks like to start a business from scratch and sell it to an oil and gas company, how to go through multiple different offers and knowing to say no to be able to choose the right offer that's the right fit, talked about basically what it looks like to do business in Canada and kind of some of the changes there and how to structure those deals, and last but not least, knowing that it's okay to not know everything and how to kind of stumble your way forward, figure out what you need to know just to kind of make that next leap. Casey, what were some of your big takeaways?
Man, I'll tell you, one of the things that hit me the most about Josh was he's very principle-centered. Now, it doesn't really matter what faith you have. It's about having the faith and being principle-centered. I felt like he very much has a path. He had a plan, even though he was navigating without a direction, per se, or where he was going to end up. You're talking about 16 years of commitment to build that business and to then exit.
And like you said, the first couple of years, not much revenue. Most people probably honestly would have given up from there. But then what was just more interesting is just seeing Josh and, you know, how strongly he believed in what he was doing and just being willing to kind of continue forward. And even once you have success, where most guys immediately start to cash out, still sticking to your principles and just staying patient, right? But then once, like you said, once things are ready to go, floor the gas and know how to kind of start to capitalize on that and then ride that wave. And so, I mean, definitely one of the more principled people we've interviewed on the podcast has
passionate. Man, the passion, you can feel it. So I wouldn't miss this episode. It's really motivational and passionate.
He definitely moves his hands and face probably more than me. And I tend to have a bad habit of that one. So yeah. Definitely look forward to seeing this episode.
It's gonna be a good one.
Welcome to the M&A Launchpad podcast with your hosts, Casey and Ferris with Equity Launchpad. On this podcast, you will gain insights on acquiring, investing in, and selling profitable businesses in the lower to middle market. Whether you're a business owner, investor, or aspiring entrepreneur, at Equity Launchpad, we will provide you with the knowledge, guidance, and capital to navigate the world of mergers and acquisitions. All right, on today's episode of M&A Launchpad, we have Josh Anhalt. In 2007, Josh Anhalt founded GreenPath Energy, a company specializing in detecting and quantifying fugitive emissions for the oil and gas industry. As the president of GreenPath Energy, Josh's mandate was to expand the company's services throughout Western Canada and to continually innovate new solutions and technologies aimed at eliminating methane emission sources. Definitely a podcast I'm looking forward to, a little bit of a different industry than we've done historically, so looking forward to it. So, Josh, thanks for having the show.
Yeah, gentlemen, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome. So no, enjoy having you on. And so I guess with that said, you want to go ahead and just tell us a little bit for those listeners, right? What is fugitive methane emissions? I mean, I definitely like the spin of that, but you want to share what that is and how you got into that?
Yeah, you bet. First and foremost, a fugitive emission is an unwanted source of gas emitting from a piece of equipment. It is not designed to emit to atmosphere. And so oil and gas, industry I serve, love, and have been working in the last 18 years, we make oil, we make gas, and we move it along. And sometimes a flange springs a leak, a compressor seal burps a little gas. And given the size of the industry, you know, these little things can add up to big amounts over time. So, yeah, the company founded in 2007 began as myself scratching an itch. And the first itch was, I said to myself, the world favors the corporation. Laws, society, rules, regulations. So become a corporation. So basically, I incorporated myself, which was GreenPath Energy. And so we pulled some money together based on the fact that I discovered, I found this camera online manufactured by a company called FLIR that could see methane, ethane, propane, butane. And this was before greenhouse gas regulations. This is before anything. And this is when, you know, in Alberta, natural gas was trending towards $12 an MMBTU. So I'm like, that's good money. And so if we can help find that gas, put that back in the pipe, that's a good dollar amount because you're paying that gas to lift it out. And so my background is a journeyman instrumentation technologist. I was building these facilities, shutdown, turnarounds, bending tube, pulling wrenches, maintenance, repairs. So I knew where the leaks were. I could smell them. I could hear them. I could feel them. I was fixing them. I was driving out to well sites at 2 o'clock in the morning to get things up and running again. So when I saw this camera that could visualize gas, I'm like, that would have just made my job so much easier. And that was scratching my next itch. Can I do my job easier? And then the next thing is I said yes. I said, I'm going to do this. And I had just gotten married, called my boss, got some money together. A month later, I had a business, and the rest is history.
All right. So there's a lot to unpack there. So I definitely want to kind of, you know, because people always want to understand the start, right? The hardest part is the start. And so it sounded like you were just an employee at a company helping build these facilities, right? And that was the initial kind of where you were. And you came across a tool that could help you do that job better, right? But instead of just bringing that in and starting to, hey, let's build it out as a process within the company, you kind of had the vision of, no, this is bigger than that, right? And decided to go out there and start your own. Is that high level kind of the breakdown?
Yeah, because I wanted to do something for myself. And so when I looked at the industry that I was serving in E&I construction, so electrical and instrumentation, construction turnaround, there's a few big players. And the margins in that game is not in the hourly charge-out rate. It's in how much cable, tray, the margins are in the product you buy. So you need to float, you know, $10, $20, $30 million for a project. And then you get grinded down on truck rates and labor rates. And I'm like, I can't play that game unless I became one of those bigger players. But within the niche of oil and gas and having this very specialized tool, I knew I could set myself apart and I could leverage my existing process, oil and gas process background to accelerate the why. Why is this valuable to the people that I've been working with at that time for the last 8 years?
No, and knowing the oil and gas space myself, being here in Houston and been in that industry, there's just a tremendous amount of money in that space, right? So if you can solve a problem in the energy space like that, what people don't really realize is that you're solving such a big problem in that space. It's not like a company's going to nickel and dime you. You can get a contract, you can make some things happen because you're solving a big problem for them. Those leaks, those gas problems, those are things they have to solve.
But I think the other beautiful thing about what Josh did is, you know, a lot of oil and gas projects in our minds are always high CapEx projects, right? There's a lot of money needed to go start. If you talk about someone starting an oil and gas company, you think, okay, there's a lot of money involved to get this going. But it sounded like it wasn't about Josh innovating something that didn't exist. It's actually finding a real problem to solve, finding tools that are already out there. And the value is in combining those two and targeting the right industry, right, Josh?
Yeah, exactly. And getting something that in my belief had a low barrier of entrance based on my skill set, but that had a high barrier of entrance for potentially other competitors as well. And then defining a really unique niche where, you know, steel sharpens steel on a specific problem. And then, you know, especially within the oil and gas, you know, one of the tricks I'll give out to people out there is, you know, make your footprint bigger than your actual shoe size. You know, you have to believe in yourself. If you're standing against a large, you know, oil and gas company, you have to think big within yourself, even though if you're small, you know, and establishing the master service agreement, getting the safety programs in place, building the relationships, and having the, lack of better words, bravado to like, expanding with them. Because what I found with oil and gas is they were my best source of financing for my company, non-dilutive. I did not have to rely much on banks or venture capital or private equity or friends and family. While I did use friends and family in the beginning to kickstart, you know, get things going, but my clients provided the funding. I just had to be able to, you know, live a stoic lifestyle, live within my means so that I could live within a net 30 to net 120 payment terms with my clients. So we got that next paycheck.
Yeah,
and then pooling it up, building it up.
Net 20, net 120 is always a killer in that space. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but no, the beautiful thing though for people, right, is that, you know, you have to be uncomfortable, right? With any business, if you're uncomfortable, then you're growing. If you're comfortable, you're really not growing. And so, you know, with every kind of phase of as we've grown our businesses, there's always that level of comfort where talking to someone maybe a little bit bigger, more refined, they know more, they have a better team, whatever it is, but just having the guts to just get out there and kind of continue moving forward. And so really quick, so you mentioned 100%. Obviously you raised money to start, right? How much did you need to kind of get going right up front? What was that number? Because most people, again, it's they don't know how to raise money. They're scared to ask friends. How did those conversations go for you?
I needed about $100,000 to get things going. But what I did to de-risk it, so I'm one of these guys that when I get something in my head, I then spend 90% of my time researching on the internet and then 10% execution. So when I looked at this, I needed more than 100,000. But what I found in Canada is that the Canadian government offers small businesses, loan-backed guarantees to the banks that in the event that I was to default, they would provide the insurance of covering the loaned money. So I go to the bank, I fill out the paperwork, I execute under this, the Canadian Small Business Loan Program, which basically says like, hey, yeah, we'll take these people on, we'll take this company on, and if they default, we'll pay the bank. Now, in exchange, you pay a higher interest rate, but it lowers the barrier and it also de-risks the bank's investment in your company. And then for me, and words of advice I got from mentors is like, you know, make the bank your best friend. Keep them posted on everything that you're going to do from the day on there. Let them know the good, the bad, and the ugly so that nothing's a surprise. So that was a big thing, is getting that money and then leveraging that the backed money. Yeah. And then again, living within means and focusing on debt repayments.
Well, with any loan, the bank is your biggest partner. Right. Period. People 100%. Forget they're your biggest investor. They think about the guys you raised 100,000, not the person that gave you significantly more.
So similar to the product you have that you got from the Canadian, the banks, we have the Small Business Administration, the SBA. So it's probably a very similar like program, just maybe has obviously different things it offers, but it's probably a similar type product.
Did you have a personal guarantee? Because the SBA side, you do have that personal guarantee typically.
I had a personal guarantee myself.
So you're still committed to kind of follow it through. All right. Mm-hmm. So
your mortgage is on the line. Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. And so then continuing down, so you got this vision, you figured out how to make it work. You got the company started. Ultimately, how'd you start growing it and, you know, where'd you take it to?
So started by, I firmly believe, and it's who you know, not necessarily what you know, but if you know, and then you call the people who you know, you can kickstart. So what I did is I went back out, and our first big client in Canada was EOG Resources when they had a big presence up here. And so I went and knocked on the superintendent foreman's door in just outside of Medicine Hat. And I said, hey, I got this tool. I've been doing work for you. Just let me go on a couple of sites. Let me try a few things. And so we gave him a week's worth of our service for free. And you know what? People are weary with free, but in the beginning, they were all right with that. And so I came back and I found some real operational issues. Like, hey, like that leak should be fixed. That should not be doing that. And then I was able to like describe why, because I'd already been doing the maintenance work. I'd already been describing. And so took the results in the foreman's office and I'm like, so what do you want to do next? And he's like, all of it. Go, do.
And you were solo at the time?
Yes, I had a business partner at this time. Two guys in a pickup truck.
Got it.
We're running around Southern Alberta.
I don't know. Don't worry.
So that contract, EOG is a big company, right? They're big. So what does a contract look like that? I mean, is that something that once you did that contract, you signed that MSA, did you have to go out and get all this general liability and all these things? Or was it like, hey, you knew somebody and you were able to go to work and charge for your services and
stumble your way forward?
So in the beginning, I didn't even know what a master service agreement was to begin with. And how Alberta business for me for 17 years in the oil and gas space works has been a handshake. Oil and gas can be a handshake business. We look each other in the eye to say, don't screw me, don't screw you. You pay me, I'll pay you. We'll get this going, we'll get this up. And I was so... That was the beginning. Just send it in. We'll get it going. We'll figure out the commercial terms afterwards. We'll get it up and running. And that proved very successful for me in the oil and gas industry, was for me to trust people. I have an inherent trust of human beings on planet Earth. I believe you can go to any country in the world, as dangerous as they are, and you will find people that will welcome into your houses. They will cook you a meal. They'll give you directions. People want to help people in general.
I agree.
And those that don't want to help you quickly realize and you move along. And so people want to see people succeed. And so It's these hand-shaped deals that you get up and running that allow you to commercially produce an outcome that then justifies their reasoning for going to procurement, going to legal, getting up and running. But that requires trust. And, you know, one of my later business partners, you know, he had a saying, you know, with trust, you make small deposits and you can only, you know, afford a few large withdrawals out of that account. You start making those trust deposits. You show up on time, you deliver, you follow the rules, you offer communication, and that builds up trust. And the more trust you get, the bigger it gets, and the bigger it gets, the more trust you get. And then sooner you go down the line, you're not doing RFPs. They just call you and say, I got this work, go do, I got a problem, go do. And that's just running a good company.
So question, how did you reason about how did you end up pricing yourself that first one, right? Ultimately, there's a very quantifiable value that you're bringing, right? You're saving them X amount of gas on leaks, and this is what it costs to produce. So how did you go about charging them, right? And did that business model evolve over time?
Of course, yeah. No, I kind of price things out based on the value of the equipment that we bought. So in the beginning, you know, a camera was about $130,000 plus some other stuff. And so I said, what else is $130,000? What else is this price? And I went, that big excavator, that big truck, that other piece of capital equipment is that big, is that size. What does that company need to charge that piece of equipment out along with an operator at an hourly rate that is, you know, one, competitive, but it is also financially responsible for the company? So I kind of looked at like that side and I said, and then I kind of knew oil and gas rates, and oil and gas rates can be pretty good at times, you know? So I worked within those realms, and then I threw it at a wall. And so in the beginning, you know, these were $5,000 days based on, you know, a 12-hour day, the rates were good. But because we also juxtaposed it against the value of the gas that we were finding. So how I priced it was just kind of based on what are the comps within the heavy industrial industries, and then what is the value coming back? And then also is just going, I'm not going to dwell on this. I call it the wins factor. I want someone to go, okay. Then I know I'm in that right spot that now the pressure's on me to deliver value that then they're willing to pay for. But if they're like, oh, damn, I'm going to sign this now, I'm going to get in while this is hot, and like, then I've priced myself too low. So I want to feel a little like, okay, I get it. But now deliver.
I like it. That's you're trademarking that one. I like it.
Yep. No, and I got another quote, not to go backwards too much, but you mentioned, Ian, it's about who you know and what you know. But there's the phrase that I heard that really resonated, but it's actually about who knows you, right? So it's not about what you know or who you know, but who knows you as well. And so all those go together. And so I guess, so you figured out your business model. You started really getting uncomfortable positioning that pricing and figuring out where that sweet spot is. What point did you start scaling out, and what did that journey look like?
It took a while, you know, 17 years in the business, the first 5 years really slow, you know, like first year, -$100. Next year, maybe we made a couple thousands. By kind of year five, you know, we were doing all right, kind of a net $100,000, at the end of the year, kind of things going in. Now, one of my mentors, you know, gave me a term, market pull and market push. And you can only, the best opportunity you can get is when there's market pull, when the market actually wants it and needs it and they pull on it. Whereas like a market push is like trying to push on a wet noodle or a wet rope. It doesn't have tension. You need that tension to create that delta that allows for the movement of, you know, problem solving. And so we had to pivot in terms of the problems that I was solving with the equipment that I had. So in the early days, it was not about regulation, greenhouse gas, social sustainability, decarbonization, cross-border tax adjustments. It was about your refrigerator system at this oil and gas facility is losing $5,000 a week in propane. My camera can find exactly where you're losing that propane. Fair value. I'll show you where that is. You have a value coming. I can smell a sour leak 2 kilometers down the road. That's a bad thing. Hey, can you find this leak for me very quick? You bet. So I took my and I pushed it in the areas where there was value and I could extract value out of the service. Now, later on into the journey of GreenPath, you know, certain things with the Alberta Energy Regulator and Environment Canada, regulations started appearing that says like Directive 60, subsection 8.7, all producers must have a program to track and manage fugitive emissions as per the CAP best management practices. Go to the CAP best management practices. They're like, hey, there's this OGI camera. I have that OGI camera. Okay. Let's go. There's now I'm going to be working with a regulatory framework. And so, and then it's going, hey, that they have this unique opportunity in British Columbia. Greenhouse gases are reporting emissions are resolving, or Pemex is looking for training in Mexico and, you know, how to find leaks better. So you just start micro pivoting to where the problem is, you know, no different than a general contractor. He goes, I'll build you a shower. You want a deck? You know, I got a hammer. I got a saw. What do you want built? And basically that was it. And then listening to what they wanted and then delivering on that. And then there's two clients that I served, even though it was a single client, it's the field. And then there's corporate. So downtown, they have a whole different set of problems. They have different budgets. They have different mandates. And then there's the guys in the field that have production bonuses, efficiency bonuses. They got to keep things moving along. And so then I targeted what we did for who I was talking to make it palatable, because the guy out in the field does not care about climate change or greenhouse gas emissions. He wants to move another 1,000 BOE. Like, let's go. Yes. Like, that's my job. So I'm going to focus what we're going to do on him and narrate a different story but authentically and be able to talk the talk with them.
So company starts 2007, 2013-ish, right? You're starting to really get a little bit of traction. You're making some profit. Yep. You talk about the push-pull, right?
Yep.
And then around 13, 14, the emissions, the market starts to pull you, right?
Yeah.
Yep. And so the market's starting to pull you. You start to do some pivots to get your business into a position where you're going, hey, we can grow, we can scale, and we can get there. So talk to me about 13 to when you ultimately made your exit. What happened? What occurred? So it sounds like that 5 years of startup where you're grinding it out, building a path, and then it's that moment of starting to scale. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. So the 13 to 2019 was the years of, okay, now we got 3 employees. Now we got 5 employees. Now we got 6 employees, you know, still a micro company in terms of size, but revenues are really good. And it assumes all those kind of little jobs. And there's one thing, if you're working in the energy space, is it's politically driven. It's about who's at the helm of the country. Who's at the helm? What does OPEC want to do? How much gas do they want to release? And so I had to be very ebb and flow with market conditions as things progressed. I found some years, I found it very biblical in the sense that there was 7 rich years and 7 lean years. And then so having the faith in the lean years, knowing, go, hey, eventually this will turn into something else. And so in those early years, again, it was putting myself out there. And so it was those early years that I just started connecting with people. And all of a sudden, I find myself in the Ukraine. I find myself in Kazakhstan. I started connecting with my tribe globally and saying, hey, I can do this. And I can believe in myself and taking risks. I had no idea how to move equipment and people into the Ukraine or Tunisia. Just do it. You just call people and you take that risk. And yeah, you got to be scared. And that's scared, but that scared is actually a fire in your belly saying, I don't want to let my client down. I have a reputation to maintain. And I will always choose quality over quantity because, you know, I'll come back to analogy, the ice cream aisle. I don't care where, if it's a Publix, a Safeway, Save On Foods, doesn't matter. Go to every ice cream aisle. Haagen-Dazs and the good stuff is far left. Value Leader, Yellow Pail is far right. I always choose to be one shelf over from the Haagen-Dazs stuff where the ingredients say cream, sugar, vanilla, and I feel good feeding it to my family. And I can price it right. And I'm willing, people are willing to pay a margin on that. And so pushing quality projects, but not a lot, quality, so that allowed generous gross margins and decent profits that I could then use as retained earnings back in the company to invest in technology, internal software development, databases, make sure that I got good accountants on board, legal, HR.
I talk about that often. It's what I call the company backbone, right? The things that most companies don't focus on but are critical. It's sales, marketing, HR, IT, accounting, and legal. Those are the things that usually come last, but they're also so important to get started earlier, just so you're not spending the next year or two or three trying to unwind the bad habits and things that you've kind of rolled out.
First thing I realized 3 months into starting the company, I was not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer.
Find a good lawyer. Those contracts are tricky and it's just like overwhelming, right? It's like, and if you got a little bit of ADD, you just are like, I cannot sit here long enough to read this document.
No, I think once we got a chief legal officer, I didn't realize how much legal I was doing until we have that person. I'm like, oh man, it's so nice to just hand these off and move on, because same thing, I'm not a lawyer and I pretend to be one on TV, I guess, right? But it's important. And as an entrepreneur, you're wearing all those hats simultaneously and you're trying not to step in on any landmines. You're going to make mistakes, but it's about just really making sure that those mistakes are recoverable and getting the advice and tips on, hey, you should have ELP insurance, or you should have that insurance, you know, all these factors that go into building a sustainable business. And it's tough. That's what makes being an entrepreneur hard.
So I realized I had kind of a look back thing, some navel gazing of who I was as a person. And like when I told my accountant startup, I said, risk is a circle. And I want to be center or just off center. I don't want to be on the edge at any times because I want to be able to put my head on my pillow at night and sleep good that I will pass any tax audit. I will pass anything that comes my way, because that's sanity at the end of the day. But when I look back at the early contracts, master service, I took on a lot of risk.
Because for those companies,
I wasn't even aware of it.
You know, the big companies letting you
as a person.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
But yeah, because who I was as a person, where I run a very ethical company, I de-risk, you know, if there's a jar of Skittles and one Skittle is poisonous, well, that whole jar of Skittles is going out. I'm getting a fresh batch of Skittles, so I know I can eat it with confidence. So as a human, I did things that didn't put us in a position where the risks that we took on would come to bite us in the ass. So me inherently, as my human nature, it kept us out. And so, you know, as a faith-based background and, you know, my faith-based morals and my ethics and leaning on compassion and being ethical and rendering to Caesar, which is Caesar's, I made sure that we were in the good at all times. And that allows you to take on risk. And then it doesn't feel heavy because I know my conscience was cleared at all times.
Yeah, and I told with any business about taking on manageable risk, right? It's not about going all in and basically this one thing, the company is going to implode or not. It's about taking on uncomfortable things that you then bring into the fold. And if you're structured well enough, you're able to, you know, take a little bit of a gamble, but the core thing is still moving forward.
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, for
exactly
for the people that are listening, you know, the process, like where Josh has spent the 5 years developing his business, the infrastructure, the plan, the pricing, the model, the market, right? Then spending the next, you know, period of time between 13 to 19 to then scale the business, get the business into market, get all of those things to go to capitalize, right? Then on the other side, there are people in the buy side, where when we talk about it, like Equity Launchpad, right, is looking for those type businesses that have got that 10 years of track record in history that generate the business and that someone's looking to make an exit, right? Because there are a lot of people out there, Josh, that don't have that ability to bootstrap like you did and to put in that hard work that I'm not saying it's not hard work on the other side, but I'm saying that startup part.
It's a different kind of work, right? I mean, you know, that starting going from zero to one is different than one to two, two different skill sets. And some people like going to zero to one and some people like going one to two. And sometimes it's nice to buy something where someone's already ground out the basics and you step into those shoes and then take it forward.
So it sounds like in 2019, you had that opportunity where somebody saw the fruits of your labor and they said, hey, we like what you're doing. So why don't we talk a little bit about what you had to go through and what was that moment when you did find out that someone wanted to buy you?
So 2019 was, so I'll preface, I say, this is when the stars aligned in terms of global policies, energy, methane, climate change, everything. I had built a high horsepower machine that I had yet tromped on the accelerator, but I was ready to do the quarter mile in 9 seconds. Like I was ready to go.
Wow.
And so when I turned on, hot damn, I'm pushing on the accelerator. I'm going down because I know I got the backbone. Hey, hire, do. I scaled in terms of three. One person, I scaled to three. When I had three people, I was already scaling for nine. When I was at nine people, I was scaling the company for 27. So I'm always thinking about scaling ahead and then having an abundance mindset. And then so at that time, I started pushing down, revenues. So now we're breaking the million. You know, we at that time we would have been breaking 2 million, and the next year it's 4 million, the next year 6 million, and then it's 6.5, and then it's 8.5, and then it's like, but then with, you know, good gross margins between 35% to 45% gross margins and very generous profits at the end of the year. And then myself, who lived a very stoic lifestyle, and I only had a minority shareholder within the company. But we agreed, you know, we're going to put this money back into the company because we believe we have built a machine that I can put a dollar in and $1.35 comes out the other side. Nice. Like, let's keep that going. And so we got that machine up and running. And you know what? Sometimes it's like, in the beginning, it's like you're just keeping that embers in your pocket alive as you navigate these mountains and valleys. And all of a sudden, you know, this area of land opens up and you go, I got it. Blow it. And then you start putting the timber and the lumber on. And all of a sudden, it's the fire burns. But you got to keep that ember alive till that point. And so then once that's up and burning, yeah, 2019 to 2023 were the growth years. That's the hockey stick. I had the accelerator down. We were able to take that on. I made sure that we were a relatively debt-free company, you know, other than some like lines of credit on some equipment we purchased. But I didn't have venture capitalists or private equity breathing down my neck on how fast we could exit out of this. It was myself. That I had to deliver to. And so then that's when I started going, okay, I'm not going to say it's easy to get into a company, even if you acquire a company, it's not easy to get into, or if you go from that zero to one, it's not easy, but it's easy to get in, but it's hard to get out. And my advice to anyone listening here, when you start your company and you get the accountant, you get the lawyer, start thinking about your exit. Plan your exit. Jason Bourne, The Room. Okay, I got five doors. There's six villains. I got four passports. How am I going to Jason Bourne my way out of this situation unscathed? How can I maximize, you know, an exit as a business owner? But for the acquiring company, how do I maximize the value for them so that it is financially responsible for both sides? And so I started looking up, like, I went, there's, you know, the one commodity in life that is most precious is time. And so I looked at, I have a life triangle that I run, and that is self, which includes working out, social, snowboarding in Japan, whatever, family and business. And so for the first 17 years of the company, I focused on work and family, and I sacrificed a lot of self. A lot of friends were out traveling the world, doing things, younger years, but I had already started with my family young. I started my company young. And so then I looked at time as a commodity, and I said, the only way I can access self is if I can, I'll never give up family. That's forever. I have to be able to subtract from the work side to put onto my self side. And the only way for me to make that happen was to say, well, who can take this on that already has an accounting department, who is willing to scale HR, who can already tack things on? Now, I was willing to do that for as long as I needed to do, but I made the decision myself that my ego is not the company. My personal bank account is not the company's bank account. I also differentiated the difference between ownership and management. And that's two different things, ownership and management. So I eventually looked at it from an ownership position going, I need to exit from this position. And so come 2023, the word methane never been mentioned more than ever in my 17 years of operating the company. I'm like, the world is talking about methane on a global basis. Russia is being Russia. The European Union decided that natural gas is going to be considered a renewable or a green energy source. So that geopolitically shifted all energy products. You know, okay, now the MENA region is going to start shipping natural gas. You know, EQT, I saw a thing from Toby Rice. I mean, I left a thing in Houston going, USA, USA. Like, natural gas is like a decarbonization tool to weaning the world off coal, but also empowering, you know, a democratically elected, socially responsible energy sources being the energy source. And I said, now's the time. Now's the time. And so I already kind of soft shopped with others thinking, hey, would you be interested? I wasn't waiting for people to come to me. And I started with, again, who I know and who knew me and the value that we brought to our clients. Those that may have been like jealous of us, jealous of our revenues, jealous of our, you know, what we're doing. And so started soft shopping. And so I didn't go out to, I didn't hire a firm to go, you know, find the acquirers for us. I did dabble with the company. And funny enough, the logos that they came back with to say, hey, here's your potential suitors, were exactly the people that I already knew. Because yeah. I know in my business, I know every rumor. I know the gossip. I know the players. Because again, I spend 90% of my time researching and on the internet, figuring out who's who's and connecting the dots behind the scenes.
So, and really, really quick, kind of two things there I want to really kind of hone in on, right? How yeah. big were you at the time? Are we talking 30 employees, 100 employees, 1,000 employees? You know, how, you know, whatever metric you want to share there. And then the other question I would want to ask is, this firm that you brought in, right? For those listeners, what, how do they work? What do they ask you for? What is their comp model, et cetera?
Yeah, you bet. So at time of exit, we were 40 employees. Revenues kind of nearing up around the $8 million mark. Cash flow positive. Runway yeah. ahead of us. A pipeline filled with work. Healthy business. Yeah, you bet. And so now going out to the firm, so, you know, the lawyer that took me on in the early days was a firm that I eventually got connected to, and the guy specialized at DLA Piper, you know, he specialized in oil and gas mergers and acquisitions. And so I like to keep everything in the family. So I brought all my legal stuff to this firm. Doesn't matter, HR contracts, everything. So I just, hey, Dan, he's like, you know what? Let me shop this around for you. Let me talk to the guys. Like he's in like the big dollar, like the $100 million, $500 million. Like,
yeah, you
know, like you're small, but I know some guys who might be able to swing some things. So the first company I talked to, they're like, we touch nothing less than $100 million. Sorry. Talk to another company and they're like, yeah, we can get something out of this for you. Our business model is we're going to find a suitor. We're going to shop your company, and And it's kind of like a real estate, a realtor. They're going to shop your, sell your company for you, and they're going to try to extract the maximum value out of the purchase so that they yield a percentage of the amount coming. So they have skin in the game to help your company realize the best price. And so, I mean, they'll ask things like, hey, you know, what are your financials? What are your competitive strengths? You know, what does the market look like? They're not going to do the market research for you. You kind of have to know your company. You have to know where it's going, the kind of position it's in, and what you want to get out of it. And then kind of based on that, you know, they do a little bit of soft research and they come back and they say, hey, yeah, you know, I think these are who we should use. And typically, you know, in Calgary, you know, they know all the major service players, oil players, gas players. They kind of know who's swinging around because they've already done deals for them. They know who's acquiring. They know who's bought, who's sold, and they're already kind of tapped into that market space.
And they know the key contacts at each of those places. That's the most important. Yeah.
Right? I mean, oil and gas is a very, even though it's a big industry, it's a very small network. I mean,
it is very small.
And yeah, and if you've done good business, you've treated people right, you've got a great reputation, somebody knows you. And exactly. That's the key.
Yeah, that's right.
It still is a very much a handshake, even though there's contracts and MSAs and all that stuff, like you said, it's very much a relationship.
Oh, yeah. It's the key. Yeah. And you know, and that doesn't matter if any business, because even though I was B2B, the relationship, even if you're a widget company, you know, the relationship is the customer. The relationship is the person you're buying with. And, you know, in my case, it's personal. It's a personal phone call. It's a B2B relationship. It's not an online marketing Etsy store sending something out. But nonetheless, a relationship game. Going back and we looked at them, I said, you know what? I'm kind of in no rush. I'm kind of already talking to these guys. I mean, I didn't lead them on. I said, you know what? If something happens, I'll let you know. So, long short, we got approached. We got approached from a Houston player, global, you know, services and offerings. And I said, hey, you know what? They're getting into this line of business and they could really use us. And, there's one thing I learned is cultural differences between a Calgary lawyer and a Houston lawyer.
Okay.
Houston lawyers are sharp, very sharp. You got to know who you're playing with. And so when the first deal that was offered to us, or to me, I should say, I took it to the 11th hour. I went through full due diligence. And folks, when you think due diligence, plan on working 17, 18 hours a day for 3 months. You got to run your company and you got to prepare the data room, the vendor data room. You're going back 15 years to find bank statements. You're finding cash receipts. You're doing everything. And so anyone either acquiring a company or building a company, I'll advise you right now, build your data room right now. A single place for all your HR contracts, bank statements, any contracts you've signed, anything consistent, any liabilities you're taking on, insurance products, policies. Start curating it now. Scan it, put it to PDF, and put it in there, because I'll tell you what, when it comes to sell, you're going to be grateful. No different than selling your house. You want to paint the fence. You want to make the grass green. You want to make it presentable. So when the suitors come in, they go, you know what? This place smells good. It's tight. It's clean. I like it. But if it walk in and you're like, oh, damn, this place is a mess. Like, you're already on the back foot. And the buyer has the advantage at the end of the day.
That data room is critical. I'm telling you, when we did Energy Funders, we literally launched in our second year. I read just an exit book, right? Like you said at the beginning, having that end in mind, be always thinking about the exit. And then it talked about building your data room. So we took a Dropbox file. We labeled it like a normal data room. And as we went on throughout the years and months and everything, we just saved things to those files. And so it was huge when we had a chance to get through our merger. I mean, everything was there. And the buyer feels a lot more comfortable with you because they make you go, wow, you really are running a business.
I'm going to show you can bring them value too, right? We can learn from how you're doing this thing and make our processes better because of that. So
huge advice.
Yep, exactly. And so got the vendor data room set up, got going, just burning the midnight oil. Due diligence, and so like the size of my company, like plan on spending, a small company, plan on spending about $100,000 of external services, give or take, yep, accounting, lawyers, all that. It's going to cost you. Even if the deal doesn't go through, it's still going to cost you $100,000. So get to the end of it. I take it to the 11th hour. That Friday, I was to sign. I woke up and I said, I can't do this. Because there was three tenets that I stood on of why it made a good deal. One, I had to be good for business. None of this, like, maybe we'll synergistically unlock, or we'll sprinkle some pixie dust on this, and, you know, your services will help sell a different line of product that's not even relevant to the thing that you're doing. And we're trying. So, A, it had to be good for business, good for the market, good for our customers, good for business. Second, my employees. My employees were the backbone of the company. They're the ones that made things happen. We worked hard together. I'm not a leader who, I pushed the ball with them uphill, and we've been pushing the ball for a long time. And I'll tell you, in 17 years, I never lost a single person. The only time I lost a person is because either they had to move back to Ontario or they wanted to do a career, complete career change. So that's the type of company I ran. So it had to be good for them. And then thirdly, it had to be good for me as the owner. The first two are the most important. Third will then be me. Got to the end. I'm like, it's bad for the company. It's bad for the employees. It's bad for me. This is a bad deal. And even my accountant was like, Josh. And so actually he was part of the value builder platform series. And so he helped me structure things. I had a family trust in place, holding company, intercompany dividends, like, you know, working within, you know, the laws of tax and positioning myself and retained earnings and due to shareholder amounts and all that. Basically said, Josh, they're going to strip this company dry. They're going to take your own cash. You got $1.5 million in cash in your bank account, and they're going to use that cash to go back and, you know, to buy your deal. That actually is that after your net working capital, that's your cash. So he's like, you'd be better off just folding the company, taking your book of business, walking over your competitor, selling at 50 cents on the dollar, liquidating some equipment, and walking away. You'll get more value out of it that with none of the stress.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, okay, that's depressing. So
it's good to have that person there to tell you that. You know, that's a good advisor, right? Not someone to just go, oh, great job, Josh. Go ahead. I told you how it felt. And that's what you got to have.
Yeah. And you have to listen to your people that are around you. And so when I even went through my accountant, he said, why do you want to do this? You have a machine that generates money. You put a dollar in, $1.35 comes out. So I described the triangle to him. He said, you know what, Josh, that makes sense. There's some checks and balances along the way, and you got to listen to your checks and balances. And I looked at that offer. I'm like, that's a lot of money. That's still really good. But the way it was structured, and then even like the little things, employment contracts, you know, they're like, you're going to have to move to Houston. And I talked to my wife and I'm like, no offense guys, in Houston. She's like, I'm going to have to move to Houston. She's like, well, we're getting divorced. So I went back. I'm like, I can't move to Houston. I got to stay in Calgary. And they're like, well, they reworded it and said, you can live where you're at, but you may have to move to Houston. Okay. Well, little things like that, that just sort of like, they were taking advantage of me. And I knew that at the end, but I had to come to terms with that. And so I said no to that on the 11th hour, the day we were to sign. I sent them a text. I said, it's Friday. Just call me Tuesday. Don't call me. And sure enough, they called me right away. But I think it was good for them too. At the end of the day, second deal comes along. Great company, good opportunity. Good for business. Good for me, but lousy for the employees. Basically, they were going to keep the company structured as its own legal entity. Myself, I would become an employee of the acquiring company, and then I would manage the company outside independently. But the company I'd go to work for had an ESOP, so an employee share ownership program, great perks, great compensation. And I'm like, I'm getting all these benefits, but none of the people that I'm working with are. And in addition, they weren't really good at buying companies, and they were a little bit cheap. And I'm like, and I believe in myself. I believe in my company. And so again, good for me, good for the business, but it's bad for the employees. And so I just can't do this one. And again, you know, I didn't get down that far. We didn't go to the due diligence phase and whatnot. You know, it's not you, it's me. C'est la vie. We'll still do business together. Third one comes along, and I get invited to this bougie dinner in Calgary. And it's this private equity firm coming in, and they got a name for themselves. And I respect them. I learned a lot from these guys, Houston, Calgary based. I mean, these guys invented private equity for oil and gas. Like, it goes back. And I'm like, I'm enticed. They're building a global platform. They have companies globally. They have the contracts. They have the networked families that own the other companies. Like, this is, you're in the club. Let's get going. However, there's a few things that came along the way. Again, a little bit cheap. They didn't really want to respect some due to shareholder amounts. We had different definitions of networking capital adjustments of, you know, how much cash needs to be left behind to keep this company running. And one thing that was said to me that kind of rubbed me, and guys, if you're listening to this, I know you said this, but I still love you. But I came off a snowboarding trip with my business partner, and we had literally, I do a heli trip every year, 2 years in, you know, not Kootenays, world-class, like Selkirks to Purcells, they're fired. So I come off, get off the heli, I hop into my truck, fire it up, tether my phone, get on a call with them. And the first thing they said to me is they're like, we're really disappointed that you did that. And like, I had booked this in advance, a year in advance. You don't do heli stuff in, you know, a whim. You book ahead. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the boot is on my neck already. And I haven't even sold them the company. I haven't even got there. I can't do this. Screw it. I can't, guys. I'm done. Sure enough, I get back to mode. Clear my mind, get back to operating my company. And so what happened is that we ended up winning a large contract here in Canada. Large enough that my competitor calls me and says, let's go for lunch. And so I took the learnings and I said, I was like, first of all, they're like, congratulations on winning such deal. You know, that kind of hurt us, that brought us down. Is it time? Time for us to finally merge, stop competing with each other. I said, well, I took the learnings of all three. And I said, if you can respect my due to shareholder amount, if we can agree on a networking capital adjustment that is normal, if we can do this, 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 and we can get a decent size of an EBITDA range between 5 to 8, I'm in. 2 days later, they call back and they're like, yes, we can do all of this. Twice had already polished the vendor data room, had already gone through the legal learnings. I got my MBA. It cost me $250,000. but I got a real MBA on that side. And then in 2.5 months, we closed. They hit every mark. Boom, patience. Boom, 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 boom. Patience, patience, patience. The first thing that comes along is not necessary, but having people in your court, legal, accounting, my wife is my tennis. She is my strength. It's right, you know, sounding board. And when all those people go, yes, this is good, this is good, you say yes. And then you do not listen to anyone after the fact saying, oh, bad time to sell. Maybe you should have waited because next year.
No, there's always naysayers. Everybody, it doesn't matter what, any price that I buy a car from, there will always be someone telling me that they could have gotten a better deal for me somewhere exactly. else. Oh, it's just
the, and you just eliminate the FOMO and any of that from the mind and celebrate the win. Celebrate why the reason you wanted to do what you wanted to do. And then give her hell. So me, I now I'm an employee at a company, still leading my people, growing things. It's been absolutely phenomenal. The market responded favorably. They're like, hey, GreenPath, we can invest on you. We can build together now as a you now with a publicly traded company. You got resources, you got people, you got legal. We can do bigger things together, which was awesome. It was great for the employees. they landed. Everyone got a great employment contract. Everyone found a place in the company. So again, good for the business, great for the business, great for the employees, and really good for me. And I found those three tenants and I stuck to those, and that got me the best possible deal. And in, and also for the acquiring company, they bolted on some serious bench strength. They got some well-motivated, well-greased, well-organized, professional organization coming in that allowed us the first day of that acquisition, first day that we were operational together, we were already closing deals together. We were already merging the org chart. We were already hitting stride and just and firing on not all cylinders, because it's rough in the first bit.
Yeah.
But we, you're going, you're doing, and we're greasing together and making things happen. And it's really been magical.
First,
what a great story.
Absolutely.
And 2007 to 2023. Man, that's a great journey, man. And very excited to hear your story.
And really, really quick before we wrap up, you know, for those listeners, was there a lot of negotiation around multiples, and what kind of multiple does this type of business go for?
Not a much, lot of negotiation, you know, because one of my mentors always told me to, companies are bought, they're not sold. And so I gave my range 5 to 8, they landed on a 6.5. And I was like, you know what, fair play. As a service-based company that's not selling widgets, that doesn't have any patents or trademarks, but our goodwill is really strong, and our demonstration of generating cash flow and repeat business, and a strong management team and a strong employee base, justified those EBITDAs, and a very good brand name. The market, we, you know, I wanted to Kleenex ourselves. I wanted people to know when they think emissions in Calgary, they thought Green Path. We were the company. I achieved that. And so that would kind of help justify, and it still carries on through.
No, it's a great multiple, actually. More than I would have thought for kind of a services project-based company. So awesome.
Good. Congratulations to you.
Congrats. No, definitely an epic journey there.
Yeah, there's a lot to uncover when we talk about it.
Yeah, we'll do the debrief after, Josh, and
very principle-minded, very centered. I love the stoic statement you've been saying the whole time, because I very much understand what that means. And for those that don't understand it, stoicism is a choice. But I think it is a practice that's pretty amazing, right? And so pretty cool. So want to jump into the rocket round?
Let's do it. So before we wrap up, right, as always, we like to do our rocket round, where we ask three questions to each person we bring on the show. So first question, Josh, what do you like to do in your free time?
Free time, of course, on the triangle. It's family. I got two boys and a girl. A girl, 13, she loves flag football. She loves anything in the NFL. So now it's just attending football games with her. Seeing her play flag, seeing her rush a QB and grab that flag.
You're talking about actual, like, American football, not soccer football.
American football.
And it's funny because you mentioned your triangle, and I've always heard it as basically, you know, you have health, family, and work. Choose two, right?
That's right. So I choose. And then with my wife, I love going to a soccer game. So competitive soccer's really kicked up on that side. Seeing that, my little guy. You know, he's exploring what he's still into, and just, yeah. And then getting out on snowboarding. I just wrapped up a 2-week snowboarding trip with some friends in Japan.
I want to talk about that with you here after the show. So
yeah. And again, heading back out into the Kootenays to go get some backcountry access on some, well, there's a lack of powder in Western Canada this year, but still, if it's ice, I'm on it. And I love that side. And I'm a pretty low key guy. Other than that, dabble in skateboarding in the summer when my body still holds up. And yeah,
fantastic. All right, next question here is: what's the most memorable moment in your business journey?
The most memorable moment. It goes back to when I was talking about EOG Resources, and when I delivered the first invoice to them, and they paid it. And it was like $4,000 and some, just shy of $5,000. I had a 1994 Toyota Camry that I was bombing around in. And I remember driving away, shaking, going, this is real. I felt like I'd almost robbed someone. I'm like, they're willing to pay this for this? This is
awesome.
Phenomenal. It was validation that what I had started, there was there. That was the first ember. And just that like, yes, like, like, let's go. Like, that's that moment.
Awesome. That's awesome. Perfect. And then the last question, what's your favorite tool or resource?
People, mentors, Joe Lucas, CTAC, old Hungarian fellow who invented environmental. It's wisdom of others. It's listening. It's researching. That's the tools and just being, for lack of better words, a child's mindset of exploring the world absolutely every day and keeping absolutely everything fresh. And listening to those of others, preferably in person, and being vulnerable to them, really expressing what's going on, so that they can really give true, you know, sage advice back. And it's not so much, you know, when I look at things, it's also, I'll dabble off a few. I'm a big Tim Ferriss fan. I got all the books. I've crushed the Tim Ferriss stuff. Tools of Titans, I love. That's my bathroom read. What's going on? Like, what can I pick up from others who've done? And absorbing the world that is around me and saying, coming back. And then lastly, is my faith. My faith, I pull a lot of biblical principles. There is truth within the Bible. And there's a lot of concepts that keep me grounded. And I've come to believe there is nothing new under the sun, absolutely nothing. The only difference is the speed at which it's being done and the medium of which it's being delivered.
Awesome. Beautiful. A man of many tools and resources. So Josh, thank you for being on the show. And last question, how can people get a hold of you?
LinkedIn. That's my social media. Joshua Anholt on LinkedIn. Find me on there. Happy to connect. And thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for letting me share my story. Josh,
passion. I mean, just all of those things you bring to the table. So a just beautiful really, story. Really enjoyed having you a part of this.
Thank you very much, Josh. Appreciate you being on the show.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the M&A Launchpad podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast and would like to support us, please leave us a rating and a review after you listen. If you're looking for guidance on your next business acquisition or sale, capital to support your next business transaction, or to invest in a private equity opportunity, visit equitylaunchpad.com to learn more and to connect with our team. If you know of an individual who would be a great guest for the show, head over to equitylaunchpad.com/nominate, where you'll have the chance to refer yourself or someone else to be a guest on our show. I'm Casey Minshew, and I look forward to talking with you next week.